Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Some Christians wonder if boycotting businesses is really biblical, and that's a fair question. Ed Vitagliano and M.D. Perkins address that subject in depth in the AFA Cultural Institute video, Stewardship in Action, The Power of the Boycott. They share the purpose of boycotts and show how they can impact the culture. We're giving that DVD to you free as our thanks for supporting AFA this month. Go to AFA.net today for more details. AFA.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, October 13th. Today is Columbus Day. It is back to being Columbus Day, by the way, as it always should have been. None of this Indigenous Peoples Day nonsense. And that's just one of many wins of President Trump in just the recent present. So as we are speaking live, President Trump is in Israel and looking to bring the hostages home as really the first part of this Israeli peace deal. So as we are speaking, Donald Trump is addressing Israel's parliament just as the last of the surviving hostages return home after 737 days in captivity. Can you imagine? 737 days. So the U.S. president received a hero's welcome and was described ahead of his address, this coming from The Telegraph. He was described ahead of his address as, quote, the best friend Israel has ever had in the White House. And meanwhile, the Democrats are probably the worst friends that Americans have in Congress because the shutdown continues with no budging at all from the Democrats. And one of my friends posted on X, Trump didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize, but he did prove that Hamas is easier to negotiate with than Democrats. So I think that's apt. On that note, let's welcome in our first guest this morning, Ron Coleman, who is an attorney and host of the glorious podcast, The Coleman Nation. And Ron, good morning. And first, let's go to this peace deal. This is really incredible. Your thoughts as someone, of course, who has not only supported Trump, but is Jewish as well. I know that this is very near and dear to your heart.
Well, it's amazing. You know, today is the last intermediate day of the Sukkot festival, known in English as Tabernacles in this direct translation. And on each day of this festival, we recite as part of our morning prayers the psalm that states, "This is the day that the Lord has made for us to be joyful and happy on it." And it is, I think a lot of people can have a highly unusual amount of focus and concentration this year. And of course, tomorrow is the beginning in Israel of the holiday of Simchat Torah, of, you know, the anniversary of this awful slaughter that took place that is literally being celebrated by, well, people who are wicked. So it's an extraordinary phenomenon. And to hear President Trump speaking in the Knesset, it's the historical significance of this is just beyond comprehension.
Yeah, it is truly an incredibly an historic moment. Do you think that not only will this peace deal actually bring an end, but in the short term, there are concerns that the hostages as well as the bodies that Hamas has said that they will return are actually the people that they purport to be. And, you know, there's rising concern as well that, you know, some of these remains that are being returned may be have, you know, grenades in them, you know, some of these other things that obviously would not be part of that peace deal.
Well, let's put it this way. Hamas follows in the grand Palestinian Arab tradition of never losing the opportunity to lose an opportunity. If they do something that foolish in a situation such as this, where they have already given up any leverage they might have had, and to go ahead and then humiliate not only the Israelis, but the President of the United States and the United States of America itself, all they will be doing will be guaranteeing a level of find out that will be even beyond anything they've experienced so far.
So you're saying they're Democrats, basically. You know, they're the precursors.
They will not learn. That's right. Terrorists don't learn lessons. They only learn survival. So far, their survival has been guaranteed by the left and by the nations of the world that seem to be extremely comfortable with evil. Hopefully this time. I mean, let's look, these concerns that you raise, I mean, you have been on the air while the hostages, videos of the hostages have been streaming across the internet. These are the real people. These are, you know, their relatives are greeting them. They're nattering to each other in Hebrew. It's really a very, very touching thing to see. These are the people. Are they going to booby trap corpses? That would really be, there's nothing that's too depraved for these people to do, but I'm pretty skeptical.
Well, that's encouraging at least. And, you know, President Trump said during, I believe it was his flight over on Air Force One, that, you know, people are tired of this war. I mean, it's gone on, this conflict has gone on, you know, for generations. I mean, since Isaac and Ishmael, I mean, this has been just thousands of years. And do you think he's right about that overall? That I mean, I know that certainly Israel wants peace, but I'm not so sure that the other side is necessarily tired of it. Maybe just thinks that they can't actually prevail.
Well, they don't think that they cannot prevail. They are not tired of it. They have absolutely dedicated their lives and the lives of their progeny, the lives of everyone in the world are, you know, one of the things Islam teaches is that Isaac was not the one who was bound up to be sacrificed by Abraham, but rather that it was Ishmael. They are prepared to sacrifice Ishmael, their entire nation, as part of their dedicated commitment to destroying not only everyone in the world who stands in the way of Islam and jihad, but also especially Isaac's descendants.
And, you know, I'm speaking with Ron Coleman, who's an attorney and host of the Coleman Nation podcast. You can follow him on X. And speaking, Ron, of a commitment to destruction, I want to get your comments on California and New York, both of which seem just bent toward destruction. First, late last night, it came out that California's AB 495 was signed into law by Gavin Newsom. This is this just horrendous legislation that threatens child safety and parental rights. The bill is dubbed by some as state-sanctioned child trafficking. Our good friend Pastor Jack Hibbs posted on X as well as Instagram. Listeners will recall, you know, this is the bill that he basically said if it ultimately signed into law, he's going to tell everybody, you know, get out of California. Your thoughts on this legislation? I mean, it just seems like there's nothing that Democrats are too ashamed to do and undermine in the name of their militant so-called progress, but truly it's becoming ultimately a Marxist state.
Well, I'm not aware of any Marxist state that has signed this kind of law, bill into law, or enacted this kind of. It's true that in a true Stalinist, or Maoist environment, there are no parental rights, but there's no morality other than the morality of the state. Still in all, the commitment of the state of California to not only tolerate, but now we see to adopt and enforce the most depraved levels of immorality is mind-boggling.
It truly is. And I mean, to say that we're potentially even worse off in California than a Marxist state is quite something. And this also goes into New York, where you have a literal Muslim communist that is running for the mayor of New York City there, Mamdani. And there was a clip. I don't have time to play the whole thing, but I'd encourage listeners to go and read the Breitbart article, listen to that embedded clip. We might play it later this week. But Peter Schweitzer, who is the president of the Government Accountability Institute, said that the family of Zohran Mamdani is joined at the hip. Those are his words, with Qatari's royal family. And he said, what you have to understand is that this election for mayor in New York is a really dark echo of the 9/11 terrorist attack. And if you wonder, what do I mean by that? Well, look at the family itself. They are joined at the hip with the royal family of Qatar. They've sent them millions of dollars, funded their project. So why does this family matter? It matters because back in 1996, this person, Khalid Mohammed, was the mastermind of 9/11 attacks and was granted sanctuary by this very royal family. I mean, this is ultimately, I think, an attack on America's sovereignty.
It is, and it's something that, again, the political forces in the state of New York have aligned morally and politically with the political forces that rule the state of California. These places have really become Sodom and Gomorrah in almost every conceivable way that you can make that analogy. I hope that we can find the 10 righteous people that Abraham couldn't find in those two cities. I know that, in fact, that you can. So they, with God's grace, they won't be destroyed. But it is... I do think that the Trump administration, which, as we speak right now, Jenna, is becoming more and more powerful and unstoppable than anyone ever, and that includes both you and I, at our best moments, ever thought possible. I think there are measures that it can and probably will take with respect to this wonderful family that seems to be on the precipice of being in power in New York.
Yeah, I cannot underscore this loud enough for all of our AFR family listeners that we really need to be paying attention to the influence of Qatar. I think that there is more and more that is going to be forthcoming. There is now this Air Force facility that Secretary of War Pete Hegseth announced is going to be built in Idaho for Qatari F-15, I think, are the fighter jets there. I mean, there is so much more that's being done in order to facilitate that allyship, when without recognizing that billions and billions of dollars have been spent to undermine American values here in America. And so I think Ron Coleman, I think that this is a moment that we really need to be very concerned and perhaps alerting the Trump administration to say, you know, these aren't you know, really great great events that that are happening?
I think that I really am very confident that the Trump administration is well aware of what's going on. I mean, there are so many times that we have underestimated this second, and you know, Jen, I think you'd have to agree. This is not like the first Trump 1.0.
Definitely.
So different in
Absolutely.
So many ways. I mean, this peace deal came out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is absolutely true. And we can only hope that the second Trump administration is very well aware of some of these dangers that Qatar poses. But Ron Coleman, really appreciate it. Follow him on X. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, speaking of crazy Democrats that may get elected to office, there's been a breakdown, I think, and perhaps a just tearing back of the curtain and showing exactly what several of the Democrats who are in gubernatorial races across the country are actually thinking. And of course, I'm talking about Virginia and also California. And so there are some new polls, and one of the Virginia newspapers is asking, did Virginia's gubernatorial debate change voters' minds before Election Day? Of course, this featured a Democrat candidate, Abigail Spanberger, who it did not disavow or condemn the text messages from Jay Jones, who is running as for Virginia Attorney General, and those vile text messages that were released where he suggested that he actually wanted to kill or to see killed the family and children of his opponent, who is the current attorney general. Just horrific. And those clips that came out from that debate just show an utter failure to just rise to the occasion of basic morality. So there's that. And then there's also Katie Porter, who is running for California governor. And The Hill is their headline is knives come out for Katie Porter over recent videos. The Los Angeles Times is reporting outbursts by Katie Porter threaten gubernatorial ambitions. She is the one that several disastrous videos have been released last week. The first one where she quit an interview because she couldn't actually answer any follow-up questions. I mean, shocker. It's she's never actually sat for an interview, even though she was previously served in Congress. And then she was doing a Zoom video and a staffer was behind her, and you've probably seen the video where she's yelling at the staffer, "You're in my shot, you're in my shot, get out of my shot," and you know, among a few other choice phrases. So people are kind of seeing the masks come off for Democrats. So where do these races stand in particular, and with the government shutdown, are Americans finally tired of these, you know, just really ridiculous Democrats? Well, let's welcome in Mark Mitchell, who is the CEO of Rasmussen Reports, one of the great polling companies, and you can follow them on X as well. So, Mark, let's start in Virginia. How does this race look? And is Winsome Earle Sears, who, of course, is the Republican candidate, did she get a boost from all this?
I haven't been polling that race myself, and the polls I've seen, she's been pretty far behind, and I think I saw one not too long ago that hit him a lot closer. And the other race, you know, with that Democrat that made that foul remark, I think it was Trafalgar put one out that hit him up. So that's pretty astounding, because to be honest, what the trend that we've been noticing is that Democrats really don't care about that stuff. Like, there's just a lot of identity group loyalty there, where it takes a lot for them to reconsider who they're going to vote with. And that works on the right, too, because Donald Trump's approval rating has been incredibly sticky, especially with Republican ID people. And I mean, I would just assume that Katie Porter's going to go on to win because, like, look at Gavin Newsom and the stuff he does with his hands. Like, people don't care about that stuff. And she is. If you watch the video, I mean, it is deeply, like, fundamentally disturbing on a human level, the way, not just, like, how horrible what she did. It seems like very peculiar, sort of uncanny behavior. And I guess that's not a problem. And there was another poll that somebody asked Democrats in Virginia if that behavior was something that would prevent them from voting for that candidate. And like almost 90% of them said no. The one I've been polling is the Cittorelli race in New Jersey. And I think there's like deeper things that people need to come to terms with. And I actually have Jack Cittorelli down 6 points in my polling, which is actually 2 points to the left of the Real Clear Politics aggregate. Emerson had the race tie. Qantas had the Jack Cittorelli only down 2 points. I have him winning with everybody but 18 to 39-year-olds. And we'll see. I mean, there's like a month till the race. And he did lose just by 3 points back in 2021. A lot of people thought that he won and that there were election fraud concerns. But I think the reason he got as close as he did was a lot of blowback because of COVID, a lot of anger over Phil Murphy and the stuff he was doing at the time and the way blue states were responding to COVID. But if you look at New Jersey, everybody on the Republican side certainly looked at the 2024 election and said, you know what? It's a bright new sunny day. The entire country is moving to the right. Everybody's becoming conservative. And Donald Trump lost by, you know, single digits in New Jersey. He outperformed what everybody expected. But when I poll New Jerseyans, they still kind of seem like Democrat socialists. They still don't seem that unhappy with their blue state situation. Their number one issue is grocery prices. It's not necessarily taxes. And New Jerseyans just got brutally savaged by property taxes. And when you ask them things about, like, how happy are you with your public schools, like 60%+ of them are almost at least somewhat happy. And so for New Jersey, at least, if the right is counting on the boiling water that the frog is sitting in to get hot enough for it to jump out, like, it's not actually doing that. And across the board, especially for younger voters, I don't think the message of conservatism is hitting home. Because these people fundamentally are growing up in a different society than we did. Very non-religious, very terminally online, not a lot of hope economically. 62% of them think the economy is unfair to young people. A lot of them are afraid they're never going to be able to buy a house. Half of them think that it's not possible for everybody who wants to work to find a job. 17% unemployment rate in that age bracket. The whole bunch of them, like 17% of them also, are single, not even dating, checked out, like don't care, like not trying to find a mate at all. And then there's incidents of mental health, like 35% of them say they've been diagnosed with a mental health condition. These people want a Democrat socialist, and so does the left. Look at what's happening in New York. Look at Mamdani. That's not a fluke. That's what people want because they think the system of capitalism has failed them, and they don't. This isn't 20 years ago where we're talking about the finer details between how Democrat and Republican policies on entitlement reform or health care differed when it comes down to the end when they negotiate to put a bipartisan legislation through. And also, I think, you know, we see it with the shutdown. Like, people don't care about the shutdown. It hasn't affected Trump's approval rating at all. Last time, he plunged by, like, 10 points. Hasn't affected him yet. And everybody thought this shutdown was coming, even though it wasn't very clear just from watching the way the legislators were behaving. And look at the way the left is talking. They're dug in. They want this shut down. George Soros wanted the shut down. And the right wants it as well. They think that this is a tool that Trump can use to get spending cuts. So it's like everything has become increasingly more existential. And also the idea that, like, somehow this movement is built on conservative principles is dead. It's about trying to drastically change a system that has failed the majority of Americans. And if the right doesn't figure out how to do it, the left's going to figure out how to do it. And I don't think we're going to like how they go about it.
You know, as you were talking, it reminded me of that old game show, Whose Line Is It Anyway, where everything's made up and the points don't matter. I mean, it just seems like that's kind of where yeah. where we are, right? And it's amazing, though, the disconnect between what Gen Z wants and where they're attributing, where these younger voters are attributing the failures of capitalism instead of the underlying worldview premise. And obviously, as you're speaking here, you know, saying basically Republicans don't get it, because it also reminds me of, you know, the Christian support for Israel, where, you know, back 20, 30 years ago, it was just a presumptive moral and theological position that, of course, the U.S. supports Israel, and the right really didn't have to defend it beyond that. But now, in this next generation, everybody's questioning everything, and we have to come as conservatives with better answers. So where do you think the disconnect yeah. is between what Gen Z voters are thinking is the problem versus where Republicans aren't sufficiently answering it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you can see it on Twitter. Twitter's the marketplace of ideas. It's the public discourse. And you can see that this argument that, well, you know, you should question everything, but there's still some things you shouldn't question, is not going over well. People are done. Like, they are done not questioning things. And the same goes for Israel. And a lot of people are just still arguing that, well, Israel is the one thing that you can't question. Well, it hasn't worked. I've tracked the polling. And listen, October 7th was a big deal. Everybody looked at it and said, oh, this is horrible. There was a lot of support for Israel, the highest we've ever had in our polling. The one benchmark question, we have a lot of them, but the one benchmark question we've been following is, generally speaking, do you support the Israelis or the Palestinians more? And Israel got up to plus 41 there back the week after October 7th. It's down to only plus 13 now. And it's underwater with every voter under the age of 50. And those people are going to be online more and looking at the internet. And so obviously there's this aspect of social media that has completely got away from the ability to influence opinions on this. But even among Republicans, the numbers are down almost 30 points. Israel went from plus 54 down to in the 20s. And we asked another question about, well, are you supportive or do you oppose a war to defend Ukraine against Russia, Taiwan against China, or Israel against Palestinians? And the Israeli war is the least popular. Only 38% support it, only 19% strongly. But Republicans, it's only 51% support. Only 30% support strongly. And now, is that specifically a signal about Israel? Well, it's, again, it's the least popular war, but it is the most popular war among Republicans. But that means that none of the wars among Republicans do better than half. And so, again, I think that's an America First signal. Like, we have to get our house in order because we're just not in the situation. I think it's becoming existential. And as far as the Zoomers, basically, they're being indoctrinated, like you said, into a different set of worldviews and values. And so for decades, the conservatives have said, well, if you don't change, this is going to happen. Well, guess what? It's happened. Only 18% of Zoomers consider themselves very religious. Even the ones on the right, this is what's wild, is we did polling and everybody's like, oh, look at how much they voted for Trump. They're going to be so conservative. Turning Point USA is working. Well, no, it's not. Turning Point USA is popular because it's the only thing that's working, but it's not working. Even the ones that voted Trump, like 3/4 of them want to nationalize major industries like healthcare, tech, and energy. Almost 60% of them supported excess wealth confiscation. Only 1/3 of them said no when asked what the income caps should be set at. And so, again, it comes back to, like, these people want a Democrat socialist by 20 points. And just because they voted Trump, they're never going to vote Republican. It's just not going to happen. And the Republican Party does not have a message for them. The you know, your granddaddy's Republican Party would tell these people, well, suck it up. You got to get out there. You got to hand walk your resume to the boss. No. Those jobs have been given to H-1Bs. Like, they literally don't want to hear this sob story about how they have to pull themselves up by the bootstraps because the prior generations have cut the bootstraps. And so if the Republican Party can't, like, within a year or two, get itself in order and with every fiber of its being go after that message, then it's going to be politically irrelevant. That's just how it's going to be. You're going to see Bernie Sanders and AOC in the White House.
And that is a really scary eventuality that I think we need to, as conservatives on the right, need to sober up and actually look at, instead of kind of having these rose-colored glasses and thinking that because we are rational and we see the end result of these worldviews and we want, you know, lesser government and we understand the founding and, you know, all of these great, you know, philosophical arguments, that somehow those are convincing to people who really don't see the world the same way that we do. And so it's mind-boggling, I think, Mark Mitchell, to a lot of Christian conservatives, that there could be anyone that would support these kinds of candidates that we've just been discussing and say, how could someone go out and vote for them? They don't comprehend that there actually is a whole generation that is viewing politics through a completely different lens. And I want to ask you if there's a connection between this whole conversation and something else that you posted. I'm speaking with Mark Mitchell, who's the CEO of Rasmussen Reports. And you posted this back on October 7th, where you said there are two types of Christians. Christians who want the church to stay out of politics, they're pro-choice by 38 points. Christians who want the church to get involved in politics are pro-life by 28 points. And, you know, I think that there has been a drastic consequence to people saying, the church saying, politics is too dirty and, you know, we want to stay out. There's maybe an intersection on a couple of issues that we care about, but not seeing it more broadly, and basically turning the country over to godless populism and suggesting that we don't have to fight for our worldviews and actually convince people that it's just going to happen because, of course, that's rational.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fourth turning, baby. It's it. We're done. The institutions are going to collapse and people are going to tear them apart brick by brick. And they just haven't necessarily woken up to the fact that most of the mainline denominations have been completely corrupted in the name of neo-modernism or whatever it is. And I think also politically, the Republican Party. And I think people on the right are so hopeful and trusting of people. Once they get into power, the question's like, oh, is Mike Johnson a good guy or is Mike Johnson a bad guy? Yeah, he's probably a good guy. But every shred of money that backs him and every special interest in Washington, D.C. does not want this system torn down. And the system is failing people. And it's like that religiously as well. It's like, yes, there is good news. A lot of people in America, 72% of them, still believe in Jesus Christ. But we're getting down to 61% now who only say they're at least somewhat religious. Only, I think it was 64% last time I checked, who identified as either Protestant, evangelical, or Catholic, so Christian. And we did poll on Christians. And, you know, what's kind of weird is that, yes, evangelicals go to church a lot. Yes, Protestants go to church a lot. Yes, the Catholics go to church a lot. But then if you ask them, and again, I don't like the idea of taking religion and using political questions as a proxy, but there are like major things that we argue about on a daily basis that do have religious ramifications, like abortion. And if you look at pro-choice and pro-life, like you said, it defines a very different set of morals depending on how people identify as Protestant or as evangelical, because they were very far apart on that issue. And evangelicals supported Trump by 30 points. Protestants were split. Again, I don't want to make it about politics, but Kamala Harris and Donald Trump were very different on the issue of abortion. And we even asked that very specifically. Like, okay, looking at these two candidates, forget who you're going to vote for, who most closely matches your values on abortion. And, of course, Kamala Harris is for unfettered abortion, including abortion at any point up until the moment of birth. And it was almost 80% of Democrat Christians who said Kamala Harris, almost 80 plus percent of Republican Christians who said Donald Trump. And then even more basic questions, like, is your church part of a large denomination or is it part of a small or no denomination? And people who said large denomination were pro-choice plus 4. People who said small were pro-life plus 17. So everything's been co-opted and corrupted. I mean, so wow, people who identified as Protestant were 7 times more likely than people who identified as evangelicals to support abortion after 6 months. It's like, why, like, the same book. And why is that happening? Like, why? It's almost like the true religion is leftism And the preachers know that, and they're crafting their message to be as sanitized as possible, because Christianity has been redefined by people who are not Christians to be about acceptance, not about like judgment of sin, repentance, and salvation. It's just totally wild. And so we have, again, a problem. We have a decaying of the social fabric. It's here. The Zoomers are not going to build a society that we recognize. They're just not. They're going to sit at home and watch like AI porn and not procreate and not work hard because they've given up. Now, obviously, I'm painting with a very broad brush. There's good people in this cohort, but that's it. Like, what is the church's value? Because these, some of them are coming to Christ. They absolutely are. You know, we asked 32% of Zoomers who said they were Christians say they've been converted just recently or in the last few years. And only 41% of them say they were brought up in the church. So we can't blame them. That's the thing, is like they weren't taught that church was important, and church didn't make a good message about why it was important. And their parents didn't necessarily bring them because the parents are in a broken home or trying to work two jobs. So, again, society is failing. And I look to the political messaging, and it's not good enough. It's just not good enough. John Thune, dude, you're not good enough. And to prevent the problems that we're having. Again, maybe there's going to be major change. Maybe everybody will realize that World War III, when we have to finally fight it against China and Russia, like NATO wants, maybe that'll be a wake-up call, and everybody will be like, okay, well, we can't tolerate a society that doesn't work like this. And maybe that's what will happen. Because if you look at 1929, and try and draw a dotted line to 1941, it's tough. And so history says, well, things rapidly change when it comes to the end of the fourth turning. I think we need to buckle up because we're going to see that change really soon. Because none of the system wants to be challenged.
Mark Mitchell, well, we have to take a break here, but, you know, really – sobering thoughts. And I think you're absolutely right that that Christians, and especially pastors, but all of us who profess to be Christians, can't simply transform Christianity into a message of just acceptance that it's not. We have to teach the truth, and we have to not just bring people into a saving knowledge of God, but then actually disciple them and connect the dots to say, because you are a Christian, therefore your entire worldview changes. You start living like a Christian. And this is what this means in all of these areas, including politics, including law, including society, including, you know, every subject matter, including the family, and why marriage is between one man and one woman. It's a good thing, and why children are good. It's not, you shouldn't want to be the, you know, dual income, no kids, and just living with your boyfriend and no commitments. I mean, all of these things are a result of a corrupted worldview that we are not helping widely as the church. So we'll talk about this more, though, when we come right back right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And I want to welcome in Alex McFarland, who is an author and Christian apologist. Because, Alex, I know you were listening to at least the tail end of my conversation with Mark Mitchell. And, you know, I wanted to follow up on that conversation before, you know, we get into your topic this morning by, you know, asking you this question of the ideology of mainly, you know, the Gen Zers, the younger generation that in my view has, as I've interacted, you know, with a lot of the Gen Zers, has a more of what I would describe as kind of a smorgasbord of a worldview, where it's like they can and do, you know, there's a lot of them that identify as Christians. They even go to church, and we're seeing, you know, a lot of that, especially with the young men. But then they say they're Christian, but in other categories, it's like they're okay with having a completely disjointed, non-cohesive worldview, as if they've compartmentalized every single subject matter where they can be a Christian in their view, and then they can still be pro-choice, or they can still say, well, I don't want to condemn, you know, my friends who identify as trans, or I think it's okay to have premarital sex, or I think that, you know, that maybe capitalism you know, isn't the best economic system, and it's okay that government takes my wealth because there's not really such a thing as private property if we look at the levels of poverty. I mean, you know, they have a lot of these ideologies that are very disconnected from one another, and they don't see that non-cohesion. And so why I call it, you know, kind of the smorgasbord of a worldview is because instead of having one composed dish that you would find in, you know, a Michelin level restaurant, you're kind of just have this whole buffet that you can just go and pick and choose whatever you want. It doesn't actually have to go together, but it makes up the plate of your worldview anyway. Where do we even begin to kind of reach this generation and say, you know, first of all, Christ and truth is reality, is discoverable, you know, all of these basic things, and then sort of build up from there when it seems like, as Mark Mitchell was talking about, we've sort of we've lost that coherency and this congruity.
Well, Jenna, it's great to be on with you, and I'm thrilled that you're addressing this because this is really serious, the compartmentalization of our faith and salvation, which somebody might put their faith in Jesus and say, "There, you know, I'm a believer, I'm born again, I'm saved." But then in the other areas of life, the intellectual life, their working life, their free time, their morals or lack thereof. You know, it's like I've got my faith that'll get me to heaven, but in all the other zones of life, I kind of do what I want to do. And that's not really Christian discipleship. And so one of the things that we need to emphasize in the church, and you do it so well, and I know American Family Radio, and certainly I myself, we are committed to this, is not just try and see people get saved, as important as that is, and that is important, but we want people to live a fully orbed life informed by the Word of God, you know, Scripture. And this is what is not only personally but culturally transformational, is when we live out the biblical worldview, not in silos. I've got this silo over here where is my faith that whenever I die, I'll go to heaven because I've believed in Jesus. But then, you know, ethically, personally, stewardship-wise, free time, I just do whatever I want to do. If we are living for the kingdom of Christ, we are not supposed to look like the world. And I just don't think biblical worldview has been taught enough in the American church over the last, you know, 3 to 5 decades.
Yeah, and that is a major problem with what Mark Mitchell, I think, rightly described as a lot of Christian pastors who have transformed Christianity into a false Jesus, where they're suggesting that that Christianity is all about acceptance, affirmation, and this false definition of love. And so they're not really teaching this coherent worldview. And then ultimately, they may not even be teaching the redemptive work of Christ that is saving, much less discipling.
Yeah. I mean, the call of a Christian is not just to, like, be sweet and everybody will like me. You know, Now, obviously, we're supposed to, you know, build bridges and minister to people. But no, I mean, we are living for a different kingdom. We are following a different king. And let me just say about soteriology, which is salvation. In much of the early to mid to late 20th century, American soteriology, the salvation message was believe in Jesus. And decades from now, whenever you die, you'll go to heaven. Well, that's true, but it's more than just the call. You know, I want enough of Jesus to get me to heaven, keep me out of hell, but not so much that it really interferes with how I want to live my life. That's not it. No, Christ calls us to be a disciple. And if we're a disciple of the Lord Jesus, then we are living for His great commission. We are ameliorating our beliefs and behaviors in light of His Word. We are, by the way, Jenna, do you know 13 times the New Testament tells the church to judge sin? Mm. I mean, I came up and I was beaten over the head Don't judge. Don't judge. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not judge. 13 times the New Testament tells the church and Christians to judge and call out sin, which would include premarital sex, all homosexual activity, pluralism, wokeness, universalism. So we are to, yes, we're to love people. But as Augustine said, love, the highest form of love is telling people the truth.
Yeah. And in fact, the definition of love that God himself gives in 1 Corinthians 13 that talks about love being patient, kind, in verse 6, it says, love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. So Amen. If we are rejoicing in the truth and that we have true love, if it is not truthful, therefore it's not love. And we have completely lost that in our churches today. And this is where this connection, we absolutely need to get back. And I want to talk with you about this more, and we'll have to have you back, Alex. I always love our conversations. But in just the last few minutes, I want to get your comment as well, speaking about, you know, salvation and going to heaven and, you know, what the Christian worldview is all about. This was a really, honestly, sad, I thought, clip and exchange from President Trump during the gaggle on Air Force mm-hmm. One headed over to Israel, where he actually I'll just play it. He makes this comment. This is cut one.
You had talked a couple weeks ago, you were doing an interview, and you talked about how you hope to end the war in Ukraine because it might help you get into heaven. How does this help? Does this help?
I mean, you know, I'm being a little cute. I don't think there's anything going to get me in heaven. Okay, I really don't. I think I'm not maybe heaven bound. I may be in heaven right now as we fly in Air Force One. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make heaven, but I've made life a lot better for a lot of people. And, you know, as an example, had the election of 2020 not been rigged, you would have millions of people living just in Russia, Ukraine alone.
Alex, that's so sad. I mean, either he's kidding, which isn't great, or he's serious that Trump really thinks he's not going to be in heaven.
There's only four options. Either he is genuinely unsaved, or he might be trolling the left, who would say, oh, yeah, we know there's not a chance he could go to heaven anyway. He might be a baby Christian who doesn't know what assurance is, and he might be actually calling for help. Jenna, I have two close personal friends. One is Robert Jeffers of First Baptist Dallas. The other is my former boss, James Dobson. Both of these men, and we've talked at length personally, both of these men, Robert Jeffers and James Dobson, shared the gospel and prayed the sinner's prayer with Donald Trump. Robert Jeffers said to me, February of 2016, he said, Alex, I've been in the ministry 50 years. He said, I think I know when somebody's sincere. He said, I shared the Romans Road, four scriptures, and we bowed and we prayed. And he said, I'm telling you, he was sincere. I don't know. Here's the thing. I would love, and by the way, if anyone is hearing me, my name is Alex McFarland. Call me. My email is alex@alexmcfarland.com. I will help the president understand how he can know that he has Jesus in his life. As I give God the glory, Jenna, I've prayed with 250,000 people to make sure they're saved. And so, President Trump, I'm here as a minister of the gospel, and you can know that you're born again, and it would be my privilege. Whenever you want, I'll come, and you will know that you have Jesus in your life. But everybody, pray for our president. He's a human. God loves him very much, and Jesus is as close by as a prayer.
So wonderful. Thank you for that, Alex. That is just such an evangelist's heart, and to ensure that we can, and as Christians know, we can have assurance of salvation. That is one of the things that the Bible does teach. And so if you're listening to this and you also need prayer, not just for President Trump, I know that Alex would love to pray with you as well. And anyone here at American Family Association and AFR, we would love to speak with you if you have never accepted Christ, or if you are wondering and you have questions about assurance of salvation. So as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.